Welcome to the DLA Piper Financial Services Podcast. This series discusses the big issues in financial services, providing market and legal insight into the latest trends and challenges in the sector.
Hello, I'm Stuart Plant, Financial Services Dispute Partner at DLA Piper, and welcome to the latest episode of the DLA Piper Financial Services Podcast series. Today, we're going to look into an area of increasing complexity and challenge for providers of payment services, and that is the management of risk and the offboarding of customers. I'm delighted to be joined today by two lawyers who have been advising retail and payment services clients on these issues, and in particular in relation to the management of risk and offboarding of customers. And here is Poussin Lam and Leontia Mercado. Poussin.
Hi, I'm Poussin. I'm a legal director in our financial services regulatory team, and I regularly advise clients in the sector on their obligations and engagement with the FCA.
Hello, everyone. I'm Leontia Mercado. I'm a financial litigation lawyer advising on retail banking disputes for many years, and more recently focusing on the monitoring of trends in consumer-focused mass claims litigation.
Thank you both. And over the next 20 minutes or so, we'll be looking at this particular issue. And I think it's fair to say that setting risk appetite at an appropriate place is a difficult task. And the management of risk appetite is of particular concern to entities that are offering retail banking and payment services. These risks can range from the management of relevant sanctions obligations through to financial crime and AML, but also the management of reputational risk. And in the fintech and disruptor community, this area can also be very relevant if a payment service provider has third-party banking partners. We actually see this quite frequently these days, where banks have relationships with third-party banks, and it can often be the third-party banks who raise the alarm in relation to particular activity of certain customers and look to exit the relationship between the bank and the payment service provider themselves. So not only is this about the offboarding of customers by financial institutions, but also looking at the issues regarding payment service providers being offboarded themselves. But Poussin, one of the issues around offboarding is very much the drive that the FCA give to it. And I wonder whether you can sort of chat through some of the recent developments that we've seen in that area.
So reducing the risk of financial crime is still a key priority for the FCA. And two of the largest FCA fines in the last 12 months or so has been in relation to failures to address financial crime and AML risk. And the FCA will also use its criminal powers to prosecute firms for AML failures where those failures are particularly egregious. So, for instance, where the FCA has got specific evidence that there has actually been money laundering having taken place. And so offboarding customers where there is a heightened risk of AML occurring is something that firms will need to kind of, have in mind and be doing. Another development is that the firm is making greater use of data and developing analytical tools to identify firms or areas that are potentially vulnerable to financial crime and money laundering risk as part of their new proactive data-led AML supervisory approach. The FCA is extending its financial crime reporting to more firms, requiring payment firms, crypto asset exchange providers, custodian wallet providers, etc., to submit an annual financial crime report. They'll need to start doing that from March 2022. The information that the firms will need to provide would include things like the total number of the firm's relationship with PEPs, the number of firms, the customers that are linked to jurisdictions considered by the firm to be high risk, number of customer relationships refused or exited for financial crime reasons, number of SARs made externally, disclosed externally to the NCA, and number of kind of DAMBLs, consents to continue with the transaction from the NCA. Last month, the FCA also decided to publish its analysis of financial crime reports from 2017 to 2020. The aim is to provide firms with insights on trends and developments to allow firms to check their own compliance. The data obviously now only covers retail banking and investment business, but all firms should consider how they can use the data to calibrate its AML risk assessments. So, for instance, the firms... there's a data on the firm's view of jurisdiction risk match your own firm's view of risk of certain jurisdictions. The FCA has mostly focused on retail banks. In the summer, the FCA sent a Dear CEO letter to retail banks, which identified common weaknesses in key areas of firms' financial crime systems and control frameworks. The areas include governance and oversight, risk assessments, due diligence, transaction monitoring, and a clear and documented SAR process. So it basically covers the whole kind of, you know, AML compliance framework. And firms are required to complete a gap analysis by 17 September 2021 and to take prompt and reasonable steps to close any gaps identified. And it's particularly interesting that the firms... that the FCA reminded firms that the senior management certification regime places responsibilities on all senior managers, in particular the money laundering reporting officer, to be responsible for combating financial crime.
Lisa, what do firms need to do to comply with these FCA requirements?
So the firm needs to have a robust AML policy that includes procedures for identifying and mitigating financial crime risk, and take steps to mitigate those risks, which would include declining business or terminating client relationships. And as part of that, the firm needs to consider, you know, its policy on conflicts of interest, because obviously there is a potential conflict between, you know, making money and also, you know, complying, you know, exiting or terminating client businesses where there is a financial crime risk. So the firm would need to have a documented process and criteria for identifying a client that poses a high risk of financial crime, so that it can adopt a uniform approach to offboarding clients in line with its financial crime risk appetite. And so I guess, yeah, if the firm does have clear documented offboarding processes, would this help to defend claims from clients?
I think to a degree. So the issue of offboarding can raise difficult issues with customers. And when I say issues, it's a polite term for disputes and arguments and all sorts of litigation. So it may not stop the issuing of a claim by a disgruntled customer as part of the offboarding process. But certainly a good process and a good AML policy or a good financial crime policy that you are complying with would certainly be a major factor in your defence to such claims, and a good mitigating factor for that as well. So broadly speaking, it may not stop the rise of litigation in this area, but it will certainly help your prospects in fighting that litigation.
Where a firm has identified a customer as presenting too high a risk of financial crime, for example, you know, this can happen where the client hasn't provided adequate KYC information, either at the beginning of the relationship or when the firm's doing a kind of KYC refresh, or where the firm's actually, you know, has actual kind of suspicion of money laundering, then the firm needs to start taking steps to actually offboard the customer. And once they've offboarded the customer, you know, for firms that, you know, operate on an international basis, or, you know, have offices, you know, lots of different offices, they should consider having a kind of a global blacklist of customers offboarded to ensure that, you know, the firm doesn't deal with any of those customers in any of their kind of, you know, locations and offices.
One of the questions that we often see is how quickly does this decision to freeze or suspend the account have to take place? What are the sorts of considerations there from a regulatory perspective?
So I think the steps that a firm, you know, would need to take would include, firstly, I guess, deciding whether it should be offboarding a particular customer. So what is the financial crime risk? And as part of that decision, whether it needs to actually freeze or suspend the client accounts. The customer terms and conditions you know, you should usually have a provision in there which says that the firm can terminate or suspend an account due to, you know, a variety of reasons, including financial crime risk, and would set out a process for doing so. So the firm will need to ensure that it complies with its obligations under the contract, so providing notice to the customer, wait until that notice period expires, and then, you know, close the account. So in terms of how quickly the firm should be doing this, I think it will probably, you know, depend on the circumstances. And then there's also this kind of added complication where the decision to offboard stems from a knowledge or suspicion that the client is engaged in money laundering. And where there's knowledge or suspicion, the firm has an obligation to make a suspicious activity report to the NCA, and potentially ask the NCA for consent to deal with the money in the account or the client. But during that period, the firm needs to be very careful that it doesn't, you know, tell the client anything, because it might commit the offence of tipping off the client. And so, you know, I think the firm would generally want to be doing that very quickly to avoid kind of committing any, you know, offences itself. The firm might have a bit more flexibility in terms of timing where there is no knowledge or suspicion of money laundering. For instance, where the firm's not happy with KYC information and therefore there doesn't necessarily need to be a decision to freeze or suspend an account. But the firm should still terminate the client relationship quickly to kind of mitigate its kind of financial crime risk. Recent FCA enforcement actions suggest that it's not acceptable for a firm to take over a year from the decision to close a client account to sending the client the notice to close the account, and then a delay of another month to actually blocking the client's account. So hopefully that sort of gives some sort of indication, but yeah, a year is quite a long time anyway. We would expect it to be done much quicker than that.
Yeah, I think in relation to SARS and the NCA, that really is a driver of a lot of the disputes activity that we see. There aren't many reported cases, and we'll chat through that in a few minutes. But it certainly it produces a significant amount of friction and issues between customer and bank. And I think of all the issues that we see, that's probably the most significant one, and we'll touch on that in a few minutes. But Leoncha, do you want to talk through, you know, as a disputes lawyer, what the current disputes landscape is like in this area?
As mentioned before, we've realised that the more offboarding that takes place, or the more customers that are offboarded by any kind of institution. And so whether that's the case of an institution just having a regular business as usual ping or an alert about a suspicious transaction or a failure to properly comply with the KYC process, or whether there is a wider review exercise of a certain kind of category or criteria of customer. The more customers that are offboarded, the higher your litigation risk, you know, especially if a customer has limited access to account facilities and are wholly reliant on a particular provider for their services. They're not going to willingly accept a closure of their account or a suspension of their activities. They are going to be slightly aggravated or disgruntled. So this obviously gives rise to disputes or to litigation. And there would be certain claimant solicitors that would be specialists or perceive themselves to be specialists in this area that act for a number of customers. So we would see pleadings of breaches of the Equality Act for discrimination issues, or even suggestions of sanctions breaches whenever they're faced with this kind of account closure activity. Now, those are very bespoke to certain categories of customers, but broadly speaking, every customer that has an account freeze or suspension or closure would certainly give rise to an allegation that there has been a breach of contract. So those issues then are most commonly pleaded or suggested in pre-action correspondence, and they're the ones that have the wider scope and the wider application to clients.
I think one of the areas that sometimes gets overlooked in these situations, obviously Poussin has outlined the quite significant obligations that exist in relation to SARS and and reporting into the NCA and the challenges that that clients have in managing AML risk. It's also the terms and conditions. And I think from what you're saying, Leoncio, that's something that also needs to be looked at really carefully as to what the standard T's and C's actually say about the ability of the bank or the PSRP to act.
Exactly, because these claims that are being raised are by personal banking customers or business banking customers. So they've got a different range of issues and different harm will be suffered depending on the type of account freezure or closure. So you need to make sure then that your terms and conditions applicable to both types of customers are sufficient for your purposes. That are you, whenever you're making these decisions to close accounts, are you actually have the power or the authority in your public facing information and terms and conditions to do so? And if you do, are you actually following the right process and procedure in sort of raising these accounts, closing these accounts or freezing them? So you've got to make sure that you're compliant with everything that you state in your T's and C's, and make sure that your T's and C's actually have this information available to them. And what you would find is that if you're certainly relying on a wider risk analysis for your decision or a wider review, you need to make sure that you've got the right breadth of clause in your T's and C's that allow you to do that. And sometimes the more narrow focusing, it doesn't actually give you the right wording that you can rely upon when you're coming to close an account. You realise in your T's and C's that actually, oh, there isn't anything there that we can say in our decision whenever we're communicating with the customer about what we're going to do. And all of these will get picked up by any kind of claimant firm acting on behalf of a client or a disgruntled customer. So it's good to pay attention to your T's and C's when you're conducting any kind of review analysis.
Yeah, because obviously the last thing you want to do is get involved in a huge breach of contract claim when all you are doing is complying with your regulatory obligations.
Exactly. So just making sure it's wide enough to give you that scope to rely upon. And the other aspect of it is perhaps even considering your limitation of liability provisions, because breach of contract claims will be for all harm suffered as a result of the alleged breach. And the harm suffered by customers can be very varied, especially if they're a personal customer or a business customer. So if a business customer has had their account frozen, either with or without notice, but that's placed a real barrier to them making payments to employees or to suppliers or for any kind of major business payment, their harm might be slightly different to a personal customer that has wider access to other facilities and other finance. But equally, the personal customer, if they're their sole account, will have a different kind of claim than a business account that might just need to pay higher fees elsewhere to switch services. So all of those aspects come into play.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for those who are operating in multiple jurisdictions, which is pretty much everybody these days, that the Payment Services Regulations or the Payment Services Directive, now the Payment Services Regulations in the UK and the various jurisdictions, comes into play as well. I think obviously there is a framework for the termination of payment services contracts within those, which needs to be applied, or the corporate opt-out needs to be applied, and that needs to be done right in accordance with the regulations in the relevant jurisdiction. So that these are sort of things that we're seeing more and more of that are coming into play, arising from, you know, the contractual relationship between the customer and the payment service provider. Also, I think Poussin talked about this, is the payment service provider sort of avoiding committing a money laundering offence if they continue to provide services to high-risk customers. A lot of us working in this area obviously are aware of the appropriate consent regime under the Proceeds of Crime Act in the UK, so that the bank basically can avoid committing a criminal offence where it seeks the appropriate consent from the NCA, and there are equivalent provisions in the Terrorism Act, which again can give immunity to the bank. But from a civil disputes perspective, there's also the defence to civil claims, so basically payment service provider is being sued, where an authorised disclosure is made to the relevant authority in good faith. And on that basis, no civil liability can arise. We see a few cases in relation to this, as to what is meant by good faith. I think the most recent, and we haven't really seen anything since then, was the N versus Royal Bank of Scotland case, where the court found in favour of the bank who had frozen the accounts of a customer that was offering FX products. So again, this relationship between the bank and the payment service provider as its customer. But we haven't seen anything in the last 2 years. But I think we're predicting a bit of an uptick in activity in the courts in relation to these sorts of issues, particularly on the back of sort of the greater vigilance and the requirements that Poussin set out earlier. I think Poussin was that's something that we're seeing a fair amount of. And this, the Dear CEO letter seems to have had quite an impact, hasn't it, across the sector?
Yes, I think, given that the FCA's kind of focus on AML, the risk of money laundering being committed by firms and their customers and the kind of, you know, high level of fines that's being levied, if firms are taking a very much proactive approach to reviewing their systems and controls and ensuring that they do their KYC refreshes, etc., and kind of dealing with any kind of backlogs they have in relation to that area, it is something that firms are taking very seriously.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Leontia, just back to you. You touched on discrimination claims, discrimination issues, both race and disability discrimination issues we've seen involving banks. Do you want to just chat through some of the stuff that we've been witnessing in the sector?
So as I mentioned earlier, it's for a more bespoke type of client or former client. When I say client, I mean like customer of the institution. So it won't affect absolutely everybody, but there will be certain categories of customers that perhaps are more affected by offboarding issues or are more commonly affected by offboarding issues, perhaps because of their nationality or their, you know, national origins, that places them in this kind of high risk jurisdiction or financial crime area within banks or other payment institutions. So if in those kind of scenarios, we would often see or experience that they would raise issues that they have been discriminated on because of their race, which is an Equality Act argument, actually, and they would be claiming for damages arising from the Equality Act provisions. So it's very bespoke, and it would be certain categories of customers more likely to be affected by those issues. But we are aware then that certain claimant solicitors have kind of tapped into those communities that are more commonly affected. And they are quite a motivated claimant class. You know, they, if they're coming across this issue time and time again, they want to protect their rights, etc. So what they would be saying then is that they've either been directly or indirectly discriminated on because of their race and their sort of their nationality that falls within that. So it's quite an interesting concept that I would commonly defer to the employment team in our DLA Piper just to find out more about. But what they would be saying is then that the institution involved has perhaps applied a provision or a criteria or a practice that places them at a significant disadvantage over other customers. And then obviously that's a breach of the Equality Act provisions. Now, in defence to that, it may be then that an institution has applied what we would shorten to a PCP, not to be confused with sort of PCP in the motor finance world. But that can be a good justifiable defence if it is to manage an institution's risk appetite and that it was operating within its policies and procedures in applying that PCP. So it is still defendable, and it's a more bespoke argument that doesn't arise most commonly, but certainly it will be appealing to a certain class of customer.
And we're certainly seeing borderline vexatious activity there, aren't we? We've got multiple claims, all run by the same sets of solicitors, all with the same customers, or of the same financial institution. And obviously, the mass claims, we can talk about this in another session, but the mass claims environment is quite significant, particularly in retail banking. Just before we close off, do you want to just offer a few words on how courts manage claims and group litigation orders and that sort of thing?
Exactly, because then obviously if this kind of customer base has been offboarded as part of a wider review, you're going to have more customers affected, which gives rise to more aggravated litigation or litigation risks. So you would certainly see the threats in sort of pre-action correspondence that this isn't an issue that's just affecting a few former customers, that they have got multiple customers on their book, which could be anything from 30 to 300 to 3,000 people affected. But that has rarely actually materialised in reality as part of sort of the issuing of claims. Yes, it gets threatened quite a lot in pre-action correspondence, but the actual step of litigating this and issuing the claim in the civil courts is a step beyond, and it's not one that all customers take. So we see the threat of group litigation orders, mass claims environments. They are a nuisance factor. As you've mentioned before, it seems to be a vexatious threat to try and get to make it seem like a wider issue than what it possibly is, but it has rarely actually manifested in the courts itself. Now, if it did, then the route to go through would be then that the claimant issues their claim and then makes an application for a group litigation order. And there then they would need to be setting out how wide scale this issue is, how many claimants might be affected by it, and they would have to indicate how many claimants have been recruited at that stage and are willing to issue claims, with a timeline as to how many more can be recruited in sort of a 3 to 6 month period after the application. And that would mean then that because there's so many claims, that they would be arguing it's best that those were case managed and dealt with by the courts in a group litigation order. But as I've described, what we commonly see is that whilst there is that threat, they never actually seem to manage to recruit as many as what they set out in the first instance.
Yeah, it's a really high bar, isn't it? It's not designed. Group litigation orders are not designed for these sorts of claims at all. And even though the threat gets made, it's never yet been brought forward. And I know we know that certain applications for orders have been dismissed as well.
Exactly. And it can't be, this isn't the type of claim that can be dealt with by way of a representation action either, because as we've described, everybody's harm is different, especially if you're a personal or a business customer. So you can't be saying that it's the same type of damage or the same type of harm that would be the most common route to a representation action. It's just the bother of the multiple mass individual claims, I suppose.
Well, thanks, Leontia. Thanks, Poussin. That brings us to the end of this episode, and thank you for listening. I'm Stuart Plant, and my thanks again to Poussin Lam and Leontia McArdle for joining me today. If you would like to discuss in more detail any of the areas covered in this episode, please don't hesitate to get in touch.
Any information in this podcast is for general guidance only and is correct as of the date of recording. This podcast is not intended to be and should not be used as a substitute for taking legal advice in any specific situation. For full terms and conditions, please see our website. If you'd like to hear more of the DLA Piper Financial Services podcast series, subscribe now through your usual podcast app.